have a great day.
What a year it's been. More than 12 months ago, the world was faced with a new virus. Month into 2021. We know a little more about COVID-19, but the challenges caused by the coronavirus are yet to be over. I'm Lina Hormoudou. Welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, our third virtual town hall on the coronavirus pandemic. Over 3 million people have died globally during the COVID-19 outbreak, with nearly 116,000 in Africa, according to Johns Hopkins University. However, a sense of hope has emerged these past few months with the development of multiple vaccines that are now being administered around the world. But vaccination has seen its own set of challenges, including inequalities in access, side effects, and the emergence of COVID variants. A year later, how has the fight against the coronavirus evolved? Our guests will help answer this question during the next hour. Let me remind you to follow us on social media using the hashtag VOA Coronavirus Africa. But first, COVID-19 has been hard for Africa, but not as bad as some feared, despite delays in vaccination rollouts. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
A year of the pandemic has given the virus ample time to spread unchecked across the vast African continent, from the epicenter in South Africa, which has documented more than 1.5 million cases, to even the furthest outreaches, like the remote island nation of Madagascar. The Indian Ocean nation far off the African coast has seen a rise in cases and in deaths, its health minister said.
We have the virus, which is the South African variant, and this second wave. Also, this virus has a particularity. It triggers more severe forms, hence the increase of deaths in Madagascar currently.
Africa has suffered fewer cases than the rest of the planet, but its lack of infrastructure, financial challenges, and its high burden of HIV makes everything that much harder. In Eswatini, the tiny southern African nation, the health minister told VOA last month they would soon begin a mass vaccination campaign, several months after developed nations started theirs. But in a bit of good news, Health Minister Lizzie Nkosi says they found HIV-positive COVID patients did not fare as badly as they had feared.
And what we've learned, not just us, but across the world, is that HIV turned out not to be such a major factor. It is a factor, but in terms of the people that get severely ill and the people that we've lost, I mean, from our death audit that we did recently, we found that 82% of the people that have died have had comorbidities, and about 80% of those had either diabetes mellitus, high blood pressure, and the combination of those.
WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus recently warned countries with youthful populations, like African nations, that now is not the time to relax.
This disease is not flu. Young, healthy people have died. And we still don't fully understand the long-term consequences of infection for those who survive. This pandemic is a long way from over.
COVID-19 has killed more than 80,000 people across Africa. But that number is much lower than the death tolls seen in the U.S., India, or Brazil. And as Tedros notes, tens of millions of vaccines are headed for the continent. For all the difficulties, Africa may still escape the worst of this pandemic. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Now it is my pleasure to introduce our guests who are all joining us remotely. We start in the Congolese capital, Brazzaville, with Fiona Atuhebwe, Regional New Vaccines Introduction Medical Officer for the World Health Organization Regional Office for Africa. Next, to Pretoria, South Africa, we have Professor Jeffrey Mpatlele, Vice President for Research at the South African Medical Research Council. Also joining us next from Fargo, North Dakota, here in the United States, is Dr. Bertha Serwa Ayi, Adjunct Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Kansas Health Sciences Center and a member of the Case Management Technical Working Group of Africa CDC's African Task Force for the Management of COVID-19. Finally, still in the United States, from Dover, Delaware, is Tolbert Nyenswa, Senior Research Associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and former Deputy Minister of Health, Emergencies and Epidemic Control of Liberia. Thank you for joining us today on Straight Talk Africa, and a warm welcome to all of you. Let me start with you, Dr. Ayi. As an infectious disease expert, you are faced with a wide range of diseases and viruses every day. What has the COVID-19 experience been like?
It's been overwhelming. The fact that you have one infection that has involved the whole world. On the one hand, it's been a blessing to be able to teach so many people. It makes you aware that you have a lot of knowledge that the world needs, and it's been good educating people from that aspect. But on a day-to-day basis, you're faced with the fact that you're dealing with a disease that you could catch, just like how the healthcare workers who were taking care of Ebola must have felt. And we know that so many healthcare workers have lost their lives to COVID-19. So it's really a daily battle.
Of course, it's been overwhelming for many people, especially frontline healthcare workers. Now, Tolbert Nyenswa, as former Deputy Minister of Health of Liberia, you've gone through the devastating epidemic of Ebola in West Africa that ended in 2016. What is your take on this pandemic?
So thank you for having me on, Leonard, for really having me on and doing this. Thank you very much. The COVID-19 pandemic, yet again, demonstrates the importance of global health security, that in an outbreak anywhere in the world, whether in a village or somewhere, should concern everybody. The reason is we are getting closer and closer. The interface between animals, humans, and an environment, the one health issue should take concern and be a priority for countries. You imagine, Leonard, in the past 73 years of the establishment of the World Health Organization, about 7 decades ago, the past 10 decades have been very much concerning, because the World Health Organization, for example, since 2009, WHO have declared 6 public health emergencies of international concern. If you believe a few, the 2009 H1N1 swine flu, the 2014 polio declaration. You just mentioned about the 2014-2016 Ebola virus disease in Western Africa, the 2016 Zika virus outbreak, and now the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. This is very, very serious.
Very serious indeed. And speaking of the WHO, Dr. Fiona Atuhebwe, the coronavirus outbreak has been quite dynamic with many uncertainties this past year, and it has really kept the WHO very busy. How would you say it has been for you?
Thank you very much. So this pandemic has really challenged all of us in every corner of the world. It has had a huge impact on everyone's life, sometimes dramatically. Health systems have been pushed to their limits, but it has still also shed light on what we are able to do and what we're able to achieve as we work together with global solidarity. So the COVAX facility, for example, is leading the largest vaccine delivery operation in history. And it took governments, UN agencies, donors, vaccine manufacturers, health workers, everybody to bring their efforts together to be able to put this all together at once and ensure that we have vaccine on the continent. There surely remains a lot of uncertainties regarding the end of the pandemic, but the efforts undertaken by governments, health workers, scientists, everybody, and in order to contain and adapt to this pandemic will hopefully pave way for stronger health systems and fairer international collaboration.
Professor Mpatlele, among other things, there have been restrictions imposed and alcohol ban imposed in South Africa, but the country still tops the rates of infection on the continent. How would you say South Africa is faring at this point?
Yeah, thank you once again for having me. So South Africa is the hardest hit on the African continent, and it remains the epicenter of the infection. So Clearly, there are a number of factors which are contributing to the prevalence of COVID-19 in South Africa. And my take is that for, amongst other reasons, I would say that, you know, the South Africa has been affected because of the current situation in South Africa. If you look at the way South Africans are living, we have got, you know, different ways in which people are living. We have got people who are living in informal settlements. We have got people who are who don't have proper homes. And I think these are some of the contributors, the health inequalities that we see in South Africa. And if there is anything that, you know, COVID-19 has actually accentuated all over the world, is actually the inequalities in health.
Now let's go to our viewers' question. We start in South Africa with Wasim Gafour.
The one question I do have is, with all the variants around, especially here in South Africa, we have had multiple variants, will there be a vaccine that we have to take every single year?
Interesting question from the viewer, Dr. Atuhebwe, because we saw that the AstraZeneca vaccine was not effective against the South Africa variant, leading to country to choose a different one. Does it mean that vaccines will have to be updated as virus mutate?
Thank you very much. Variants are concerning and do demonstrate the importance of collective action. Suppressing the virus through existing public health measures, as well as scaling up vaccine manufacturing and rolling out the vaccine as quickly as possible, will be critical. And coordinated action on strain surveillance, collaboration among vaccine development, research and vaccine manufacturers, along with access to vaccines by all countries, is also very, very important. So more studies are definitely required to assess the effectiveness of the current COVID vaccines against different variants. However, the current preliminary data that we have suggests that the vaccines stimulate enough immunity to retain substantial efficacy against most variants, especially for severe disease, hospitalization, and death, which are the basic minimums that this vaccine was supposed to achieve: prevention of severe disease, hospitalization, and death. So further studies are ongoing, and WHO will update its guidance as more details get known. And we're enhancing our existing mechanism for tracking and evaluating variants that may affect vaccine composition, and expanding that mechanism to provide guidance to manufacturers and countries on changes that may be needed for vaccines.
Now we go to Kenya for a question from Kariuku Jimbo.
Which is the best amongst the five vaccinees we have that can be of rare side effects to a patient or to a person, to the consumer of those vaccinees?
Dr. Ayi, that's really a good point. I don't know if you heard the question, but the viewer made a point that, you know, there are more vaccines, many vaccines to choose from. Actually, more than a dozen vaccines have been authorized around the globe so far, and over 200 are being developed. Given the choices, how does a person know which vaccine is the right one personally with less side effect?
Thank you for that question. The best vaccine is the one that is available to you, because every country went with different vaccines. South Africa went with the Johnson & Johnson. Some of the countries went with the Sinovac vaccine. In the U.S., they went with Pfizer and Moderna for approval. And so it's not as though we've gotten to a stage where people have options. You know, you have a list of 10 options to choose from. Countries have made decisions on what they can afford and what has been made available to them. So some protection is better than none at all. If you take the influenza vaccine, for example, there are some years it's only 60% effective, but we still take it anyway. And so if you have vaccines that are more than 70% effective, I think that every one of them that is offered is really good. Of course, the Pfizer vaccine has over 95% efficacy, so it looks like it's a a very good one, but I think that for anybody living in Africa, if a vaccine is offered, for now, you should take it.
So there have been many things that people have believed around the vaccine, sometimes myths, sometimes some facts. So let me ask you this question, Dr. Atuhebwe. Can someone get COVID after being vaccinated?
Thank you again for that question. Yes, someone can get COVID after being vaccinated because the body takes time to build that immunity. It takes about 2 weeks even after the second dose. So there is still a window within which people can still get COVID. But again, remember that this vaccine is not, right now we don't have information on if the vaccine spreads, stops the spread of infection from one person to another. The vaccine is basically supposed to reduce your chances of getting severe disease, getting hospitalized, or even dying. So at the moment, yes, you can still get COVID, but we hope that you don't get a severe form of COVID, nor should you die if you're vaccinated.
Absolutely. Now let's go to a viewer in Ghana.
How safe in the long term is the vaccine? Every vaccine has a side effect. What is the long-term effect of the vaccine?
Professor Mpatlele, to you, what do we know about the vaccine, long-term safety, and I will have efficacy, really, if we narrow down to the first four vaccines, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, what do we know?
So let me start by saying that, when it comes to the side effects to vaccines and the adverse events, obviously, this depends on individuals. We react differently to pharmaceutical products, and it is an important, consideration to take when taking any pharmaceutical product. So, for the vaccines, obviously, based on the clinical trials that were done and based on the limited use so far, we know that the major side effects and adverse events have been reported. By and large, these are within acceptable profile of vaccines. There are some concerns with some of the side effects, like anaphylaxis. But this is just the nature of the vaccines. So when you do a clinical trial, obviously you can't test the vaccine in millions and millions of volunteers. The minute you start rolling it out, you can pick up rare side effects. And this is where the question probably is related to, because if there is any long-term side effect, this will be a rare side effect that will be picked up when the vaccines are rolled out in the population, more and more doses are administered to the population, and one can never predict what would be this rare side effects. But there is a possibility of rare side effects, but we shouldn't really worry much about this.
Okay, and some experts say the benefits outweigh the risks. Now, let's stay in West Africa with our next question. Moussa Diop in Senegal.
Au revoir déjà avec la France.
We have seen France backtracking and stopping the use of vaccine. Are the vaccines really safe?
Dr. Atuhebwe, back to you. France, along with some other countries, paused the use of AstraZeneca at some point due to reports of blood clots. We mentioned it earlier, which has also been observed in some people with the J&J vaccine, which is currently used in South Africa. Are the vaccines really safe? How is WHO ensuring that people really trust new vaccines deployed on the continent?
That's an excellent question. Thank you. So indeed, we've had about 14.2 million AstraZeneca vaccine doses that have been administered in Africa alone, with most of the adverse reports following immunization involving only mild to moderate side effects, like the professor mentioned. No cases of blood coagulation disorders have been reported in Africa so far. We also need to know that over 60% of the vaccines used globally are actually AstraZeneca vaccine. WHO considers that the benefits of AstraZeneca greatly outweigh the risks, and countries in Africa should continue and to vaccinate people with AstraZeneca vaccine. So the vaccine remains a valuable tool to fight side effects and the illnesses, reducing deaths to up to 80%. One of my female counterparts mentioned that the vaccine now available to you at hand is the best vaccine that you have so far. Available data still suggests an increased risk of this thrombocytopenia syndrome with thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome, like we've called it, with AstraZeneca vaccines, and it appears to be quite low. And the data from the UK suggests that the risk is approximately 4 cases per million adults, about 1 case per 250,000 adults who receive the vaccine, while the rate is estimated at 1 per 1 million in the European Union. So this data shows that the risk is higher in younger adults. The age-related risk requires further analysis. But generally, the serious side effects, true, may occur. And we say that this is very uncommon. The Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety has advised that and together with the Strategic Advisory Group of Experts, have updated their interim recommendation on the use of AstraZeneca across age brackets and levels of exposure. So more information is coming in, but still the stand from WHO and the European Medicines Agency is that the benefits do outweigh the risks, which the blood clotting syndromes are quite very rare, and we should go ahead to use this vaccine.
So as we mentioned, there is a lot of skepticism around some of the vaccine, and people fear to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Here are some of the concerns that people have shared with us.
That's why I'm using my nose mask always, and then washing my hand with soap and the running water, and then the use of hand sanitizer. Vaccine is not something... No. Now that it's even new in the system, don't trust.
I'm not sure whether the vaccine itself is safe or not. One, we understand that some countries have suspended the use of those vaccines because of the blood clots of the already vaccinated people. Secondly, the way government is handling these issues, maybe some people feel what they are bringing to Kenya, maybe it is not the original vaccine. So it is upon the government now to come clear whether the vaccine is safe to use or not.
The day I see the vaccine carrying people, I will get vaccinated. But I have heard a lot of rumors on the vaccines, because people have contracted other diseases after being vaccinated. I do not want that.
For now, what I want is we need more elaborated way of, you know, getting the people to understand what is happening on the other part of countries where people they've stopped vaccinating them because of the kind of drug that they are using. So if they continue to educate us more about what is happening, because we follow, so they should give us more information for us to realize that the drug is safe for us all, then we all go there and then get ourselves vaccinated.
Well, Dr. Ayi, someone in the video mentioned that people have contracted other diseases after being vaccinated. Tobin Yenswa said that's not a possibility. What is your reaction, and what are some common side effects that people would experience, and when should they be concerned and seek medical help?
Okay, do you mean other people who have received the COVID-19 vaccine have contracted other diseases?
That's what one person said, yes. Some people believe it.
I don't think so. The COVID-19 vaccine is designed to prevent severe illness from somebody who would contract or at least be exposed to COVID-19. So I don't think that the vaccine in itself would give you other diseases. And so I want to encourage people that vaccines are useful, they're safe, wild-type polio has been eradicated using the polio vaccine. And this, even though the vaccines, COVID-19, seems to have been developed in a short amount of time, the only reason why it was done is that there was funding available. And because we're in the middle of a pandemic, it was easy to quickly prove or show that the vaccines are safe. At this point, we don't have much evidence of long-term effects. I have been vaccinated back in January. I'm not experiencing any long-term effects. And people who have received the vaccines are going to be followed very closely. And so I think overall, these are safe vaccines that people are encouraged. And I would strongly recommend that people go ahead and get the vaccines.
So, Dr. Atuhebwe, explain for us, please, the science behind some of the vaccines. We hear about the adenovirus vaccine, like AstraZeneca, and the mRNA vaccine, such as Pfizer. What is the difference, briefly?
Okay, again, so the messenger RNA vaccines, where the anti-vaxxers have been able to penetrate and tell people wrong information that this is vaccine that will change your DNA and all that. Anyway, these contain material from the virus that causes COVID-19 and gives our cells instructions for how to make a harmless protein that is unique to the virus. After our cells make copies of this protein, they destroy the genetic material from the vaccine. Our bodies then recognize that the protein should not be, our bodies then recognize that the protein should not be there and build a T, what we call T and B cell lymphocytes, that will remember to fight the virus that causes COVID-19 if we are infected in the future or come into contact with this virus. While the vector vaccines contain a modified form of a different virus than the one that causes COVID-19, inside the shell of this modified virus, there is a material from the virus that causes COVID-19. This is called a viral vector. Once the viral vector is inside our cells, the genetic material gives cells instructions to make a protein that is unique to that virus that causes COVID-19. And using these instructions, our cells make copies of that protein. This prompts then our bodies to build these T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes that I talked about that will remember how to fight a virus if we're infected with it in the future. But in short, the vaccines work in such a way that your body builds an army waiting for the enemy to attack, and they will remember that this is the enemy we're waiting for and just attack the enemy once they come up. Again, vaccines do not change your DNA material. They don't change your genetic material or anything. They're just there, simply these COVID-19 vaccines to prevent you from getting severe disease, illness, hospitalization, and death.
Okay. Professor Mpatulele, a lady in the video spoke about observing precautions like hand washing, face covering, which have been suggested, recommended by experts. Can non-pharmaceutical intervention be enough for prevention? And also, what about solutions in Africa locally? I know we talk about vaccine, but what about our resources locally when we look at, for example, herbal medicine?
So the non-pharmaceutical interventions, they do work. And in fact, we have seen in South Africa in 2020 that because most of us were using the non-pharmaceutical interventions religiously, we haven't experienced a normal flu season in South Africa. And part of this can be attributed to the fact that we were using non-pharmaceutical interventions. So they do work to prevent infections. The problem is that we can't use this for a long time because we need to return to normal life where people are able to interact without wearing masks without, you know, the boundaries of non-pharmaceutical interventions. And this is where the vaccination becomes important. Because if you are vaccinated, you know that even if you do get infected, you have less chances of getting a severe disease. Most likely you will not be hospitalized or even die from COVID-19. So, yes, they do work. And as for the other measures, especially the measures that other people are using on our continent. The problem is that we don't know the efficacy of some of the measures that are being used. But we know that this is something that the continent is taking it seriously, and there are a number of groups that are already testing the safety and efficacy of some of the products that are being used in Africa. And if the products have been shown to be safe and efficacious, there's no reason why that product should not be used.
Okay. Dr. Ayi, regarding the vaccine-induced blood clots, who is more susceptible to developing them, and how long after receiving the vaccine?
Well, thank you for the question. I can speak to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the experience in the United States. After over 6 million doses, six patients aged between 18 and 48 who were women were found to have these blood clots, and the average onset was about 9 days, anywhere between 10 to 16 days, 8 to 16 days after administration of the vaccine, and mostly presented with headaches, and some of them with confusion and with abdominal pain. And it was a little different. It's not your usual blood clots happening in the legs, but clots associated with the venous supply to the brain and associated with what we call low platelets. Platelets are little particles in our bloodstream that help our blood to clot. And the unique thing about these clots was that the patients also had very low amounts of platelets.
Thank you for that clarification. Now it's time for a short break. We'll continue our discussion shortly. Don't go away.
I would recommend being vaccinated to everybody close to me and my family members, because the government brought the vaccine in for the good of the people. People must know that instead of AIDS dating, they must go and get vaccinated.
Now that I'm being vaccinated, I feel safe socializing. Because I think it's very important for people to get vaccinated so that we could actually be go back to our lives, back to normal.
Yeah, it's very important because, you know, the vaccine prevents you from getting the virus, you know. People have the misconception that coronavirus is not real, but it's very real. I work in the hospital, so I know what I'm talking about. So I would entreat everyone to vaccinate.
Herd immunity is something we need in order to carry on with life as usual.
So it's not like maybe the whites are coming to kill us, or they will give us the poison and all. That's what people are thinking. But most of the drugs are coming from outside the country. So it's not like it's a worldwide. Something that is coming out. So but people are afraid that they will die and all that. But it's not so.
Welcome back. You are watching a special edition of Straight Talk Africa on the COVID-19 pandemic. 1 year later, our guests are Dr. Fiona Atuhebwe, Regional New Vaccines Introduction Medical Officer for the World Health Organization Regional Office for Africa, Professor Jeffrey Mpatlele, Vice President for Research at the South African Medical Research Council, Dr. Bertha Serwa Ayi, Adjunct Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Kansas Health Sciences Center, and Talbert Nyeswa, Senior Research Associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and former Deputy Minister of Health, Emergencies and Epidemic Control of Liberia. I'd like to pick up on something that was mentioned in the video during the break, herd immunity. With the development of vaccines on the continent, when should we expect to see herd immunity?
So herd immunity is dependent on the rate of vaccination in a particular setting. So in this case, of course, it would be in a country. So it depends on how quickly a country will make the vaccine available to its population to reach herd immunity. And obviously, you know, the countries are different. If I give example with South Africa, herd immunity is estimated somewhere around 70%. So if you vaccinate fast enough, you can probably reach 70% of the population very quickly, and you achieve herd immunity. However, I must caution that even though we tend to talk about herd immunity, we have to be cautious because the COVID-19 virus is a virus that keeps on, you know, I think is moving, is a moving target, if I can put it that way. You mentioned the issue of variants, for example, and if we experience a lot of variants that can escape the immunity, this can be a challenge because it might mean that even if you have vaccinated enough population and there is emergence of a new variant that can escape the previous immunity, then that will present a challenge. But hopefully we will not have a situation like that, as other members have indicated. We will have a situation where a vaccine should be able to give you a certain degree of protection against a variety of variants.
Now, let's get a little personal, Dr. Atuhebwe. You were infected with COVID-19. Could you briefly describe the experience, the treatment you receive, and also at this point, do you still need to get vaccinated?
Yeah, thanks for that. So my experience was actually, it was a year ago, because it was in April when I got diagnosed with COVID-19. And at that time, we did not have basically, we were gambling. The world was really gambling with information. And of course, when you get a disease, you use the protocols in that country. I got infected in Congo. So the Congo protocol at the time was chloroquine. If you remember chloroquine, that was all over the world. They were also using lopinavir, which is an antiretroviral used in HIV treatment, and then azithromycin, and of course then some other painkillers and that. So I was given all the three. I was given chloroquine, I was given lopinavir, I was given azithromycin, which incidentally I didn't get to take because I changed suddenly to a severe form and was evacuated to Germany. And when I arrived in Germany, they put me off everything I was on. And because I was at a risk of thrombosis, they started giving me blood thinners. They were treating symptoms. I was in ICU for a number of days, and in ICU, they only were managing symptoms. If I couldn't breathe, it is oxygen. If they see that my blood is clotting, they give me blood thinners. I had issues with my kidneys, so they were managing kidneys. So it was symptomatic. There was no drug that was given to me to prevent, for treatment of a COVID-19 disease. And yes, I got my shot of vaccine about a month ago, AstraZeneca, from in Uganda, because we do not yet have it in Congo. But of course, studies and science has shown that by now, it is 12 months later, my immunity has really waned, so I need to have the vaccine like anybody else. So yes, I did take my first shot, and I'm waiting to take my second shot after 8 weeks.
So what have you learned from the experience? Briefly, a short message you would like to share about the experience.
My message is there are still a lot of unknowns. This disease is new. We are all learning along the way. So you can imagine what the time that everyone was talking of chloroquine. Right now, even with the vaccine, and it's very important, I think, to tell people that we need to, even scientists and communicators and those of us in the technical world, people have many questions. We need to address legitimate concerns, gain people's trust, and be transparent about what we know and what we do not know. There remain lots of unknowns when it comes to COVID-19. So again, everybody, take your dose. I was young. I had no comorbidities. I really was not supposed to be a candidate of who we thought at the time that would be candidates for severe illnesses. So this disease can get anybody, and anybody can actually be a severe case and die. So go out, get your shot as soon as you have that opportunity.
Thank you so much for this, for sharing your experience. We can all learn from this. Now, here is a question we received on Facebook from Idris Hamza in Yaoundé, Cameroon. He says, I do not understand why, instead of killing or treating the coronavirus, people prefer to vaccinate everybody. Dr. Atuhebwe, when you have people that are either denying the existence of a disease or refusing to get vaccinated, which has been the case with many on the continent, what needs to be done? How do you remove obstacles to getting people vaccinated?
Again, as I mentioned, we need to address people's legitimate concerns. We keep assuming when you work at a high level and all your life is about vaccines and viruses and all this, we assume that people out there, it will be very easy for everyone to understand. So gaining the trust of communities, being transparent again of what we know and what we don't know, and ensuring that we communicate the right information, not just at national levels, but also at community levels, is very, very important. Using the mediums that people use, the fake news people use, going out on social media, but not everyone has internet. So we need to find what people respond to, and people do respond to strong leadership. That is why it is very, very important that leaders come out and get their people to gain confidence in the vaccines. And we also need to acknowledge the fact that vaccine is not there for the general population, unlike in the past where we'd have vaccines for everybody. So it's difficult also to widely generate demand for a product that is not widely available. So that crisis communication and community engagement, as previously mentioned by one speaker, is very important.
Dr. Mpatlele, what about treatment? There have been over 200 vaccine candidates, and we heard a lot about what not to do when it comes to treatment. Do not use chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine at some point. Do not use ivermectin at some point. But what is being done for treatment in terms of research?
Well, there is a number of studies and research projects that are looking at better treatment for those who are already infected. And obviously, it depends on the degree the person is affected by COVID-19. In some cases, you don't necessarily need a treatment. You just need what we call just general management of the patient, the use of, for example, oxygen support and stuff like that will help you to recover. But you also have severe cases where you do need, treatment. So just like in the areas of vaccines, where there is a lot of research, R&D, there is still research in the area of treatment, but I must say that while treatment is important, because not everybody will get the vaccine, and still we know that there will be people who will require treatment genuinely. While treatment is important, it is also important to emphasize that the reason more emphasis is put on vaccine is because prevention is better than cure. And we also know that, in fact, when you are vaccinated, you're saving far more lives than when you don't get the vaccine and eventually you need treatment. So treatment options are being investigated. There are a couple of those that are already available and are being used, but there is still a lot of research in that area.
Professor Mpatlele, given the statistic that I just shared, the African Union announced on April 13th a partnership to make vaccines on the continent, and it's really important to see that some vaccines are developed on the continent, don't you think? What sort of impact do you see this partnership having in the continent's ability to fight diseases and outbreak in the future?
This is an excellent initiative, and it should have happened many years ago. So obviously, with COVID-19, we can see that it has accelerated the process. We need vaccine development in Africa, not just by one country, but a number of countries. At the moment, if you look at the vaccine research and development landscape, I think Africa is very much involved with what I will call the second part of vaccine development, which is clinical development of vaccines. This is where a product is developed from other countries, and our researchers in Africa are able to do clinical trials from phase one, you know, all the way to phase three and licensure. But then the preclinical development is what is needed in Africa, where our researchers are able to construct these vaccines, are able to test them in animals, are able to do preclinical testing and show that, you know, they can work if they are advanced to clinical testing. So that is the area that requires attention in Africa. And the other area is with manufacturing. Because for manufacturing, you need things like tech transfers, and you also need the know-how of manufacturing these vaccines. So I guess everything is work in progress, but it's important that we have got the regional leadership to make sure that there is a plan, and the plan can be implemented, and I hope that with the plan, there will be funding made available, and very soon we will see Africa being able to compete in this space.
Great. Now to another viewer's question. Tabo Musela in South Africa.
I would like to know that if we all get vaccinated, for an example, what are the chances that we could completely prevent or completely do away with the COVID, or is it here to stay, and are we always have to go on with the mask for forever, or what's going to happen if let's say all of us get vaccinated? Is it still going to be the same as wearing masks and those kinds of things? Yes.
Doctor, is COVID here to stay? When will we see a sense of normalcy, to your opinion?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the inherent in the question was the answer, that if we can achieve that herd immunity, I think COVID will not be here to stay. A good example is the influenza of 1918, the Spanish influenza. It did end. It's not here today. Good examples are smallpox, which had stayed for over 3,000 years. The minute the world was able to vaccinate enough people, the smallpox is eradicated completely. And I always say it's the first disease that had a vaccine, and it's the first disease that was eradicated with a vaccine. And one of the panelists was discussing herd immunity. And I always tell people it's like being in a room with 10 people. If 9 of them are not ill or going to get ill, they form a circle around that one individual who is still susceptible or hasn't received the vaccine. So the more people receive the vaccine, so that's almost like what you call your herd immunity. And we're hoping to get to 70%. Now, in the U.S., where vaccination is occurring in the millions per day, we see about 30% of our vaccination status. And so in Africa, we still have a long ways to go, which is why this partnership on Africa vaccine manufacturing is important, because it's going to help us to start producing some of the vaccines on the continent, or at least fill and then use them on the continent, because I don't think we've even achieved 10% as of yet. So I strongly believe that if we can deal with vaccine hesitancy, we can get a lot more vaccines available to us from our governments, and we can vaccinate people. Yes, we won't have to live with COVID, because it's not a good way to live.
Tolbert Nyanswa, you've had first-hand experience with the Ebola outbreak. What are some of the lessons learned during that time that are helping in tackling COVID-19 now?
So some of the lessons, and this is what I believe strongly that Africa is doing well and other countries in the global south with the lessons we learned from Ebola in West Africa, lessons we learned from Ebola in East Africa, got these countries well prepared ahead of time. Some of the strategies like emergency operations centers, the incident management system setting up, engaging the community early. There is no substitution for political leadership in an outbreak. We saw African governments, the Africa CDC, got to work very quickly. Governments in Africa started early response, testing, contact tracing, and all of these interventions that are public health interventions that help even before we're talking about vaccines right now. So those are some of the things, proper race communication. And if I would say one thing that turned around the outbreak in Liberia when I was the incident manager was community engagement. We engaged the community, started from bottom to top, and the political leadership that evolved into the outbreak. So these strategies and interventions are applicable today to the COVID-19 outbreak. And one thing we should not forget, for example, COVID-19 has had impact on other diseases like HIV and AIDS, tuberculosis and malaria. If you can give me a few seconds, let me give you some staggering statistics about what the Global Fund found quite recently when it did a snapshot of 502 healthcare facilities in Africa and Asia. They found that first antenatal care visits fell by 66%, while consultation for under 5 services decreased by 74%. Across all the facilities surveyed, HIV testing as important as that is fell by 41% in 2010. TB's referral have fallen 59% in 2020 when compared to 2019. Malaria diagnosis fell by 56%. This is what the Global Fund found. Okay. Just when the report was released, this is important that we look at other diseases and not only COVID. Though COVID is important.
Yes. Now, Dr. Atuhebwe, let me ask you about COVAX, which is a platform established to help reduce the gap when it comes to vaccine access between rich countries and low- and middle-income countries. How much impact is it having? And so far, countries have received the AstraZeneca vaccine through COVAX. Is there a plan B in terms of getting different vaccines when we see that in South Africa, for example, it wasn't efficient against the variant there?
Thanks again. Yeah, so globally, by now, over 960 million doses have been administered, of which just 1.7 million have been administered in Africa. And Morocco, of course, has administered the most at 68% and Nigeria at 8%. So we see that we are really, really having a low number of doses. And as of today, African countries have started vaccination, receiving vaccines through COVAX up to 16.7 million doses that have been administered from also using COVAX doses, bilateral deals and donations. We've recently heard from India that starting 1st May, the country will want to vaccinate everybody age 18 and above. And the Serum Institute of India definitely is our biggest supplier to the COVAX facility, and these supply issues threaten what we're expecting. For example, the COVAX facility plans to distribute up to 600 million doses to the African continent by the end of 2021. So with the current level of supply constraints, it is anticipated that even if the delivery of COVAX doses gets accelerated in the second half of 2021, combined with the doses that will be delivered through the African Union or through other bilateral deals, it will be difficult for us to reach our herd immunity soon, even before 2023. So we have the COVAX facility is having regular and very intensified negotiations with the government of India that we believe will yield a lot. But also remember, we are distributing AstraZeneca from this manufactured in South Korea. We are looking at other expediting the approval. Next week, we hope that the team will review and approve, most likely, the Sinopharm vaccine from China. We are having the Pfizer vaccine has given us more doses that we shall distribute to countries that are able to handle the ultra cold chain. We are looking at more different vaccines coming in. The Russian vaccine is already under review, and we are hoping to see the Novavax and now the J&J that was approved all come in and increase the number of doses. So also looking at alternative manufacturers.
Okay, so it's almost time to wrap this interesting show, I must say. But I would like to get your final thoughts, each of you, starting with you, Dr. Ai. What is the biggest lesson for you as an infectious disease specialist?
I think for me, the biggest one was that sometimes you have to nip things in the bud, and that we don't have to allow economy, trade, and financial reasons to stop us from stopping something when it is important. Because, like, I think of what was happening in China back in between January and March, that if we hadn't looked at trade and travel, and the world had come to a consensus, I think the concern that we might lose a lot of financial revenue in the process if we stop trade, I think that we have lost a lot more lives and a lot more financial loss after a year than if we had put all those things aside and allowed a global consensus to stop the spread of this disease.
All right, thank you. I have to get the other panelists' final thoughts. So, Talbot Nyenswa, in a few seconds, what have we learned? What are the coming up? What are the priorities coming up?
I think we should look at the global pandemic as something that will happen frequently that we saw in the last 73 years in the establishment of WHO. We see high-income countries are accelerating access to COVID-19 vaccines. We need to do that in low-middle-income countries. We are now seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. We will not be out of this pandemic until the entire world is vaccinated. And we should now look forward to the future pandemic and see how we can control it effectively by building countries' capacities.
And thank you to you, Dr. Atuhebwe. Your final thoughts?
Thanks again for the opportunity to be on this show. So COVID-19 vaccines have been developed very rapidly while keeping the highest standards used in all vaccine development. The quality, the safety, the efficacy of vaccines is one of WHO's highest priorities, and there are many strict protections that are put in place to ensure that the approved COVID-19 vaccines are safe. Okay. Any approved vaccine is rigorously tested on tens and hundreds of thousands of people in clinical trials, which are designed to identify side effects. And even when the vaccine is out, we have systems in place to follow it. So what my message to people out there is to trust the process. Trust the scientists. Trust people who are out here trying to do their best to end this pandemic. Let not fake news stop you from getting vaccinated. Trust the process. The vaccine is safe.
Trust is important indeed. In a few seconds, very briefly, Professor Mpatletle, your final thought.
Thank you. Just three issues that I want to highlight. The first is that we need to pay attention to health systems. We need to strengthen health systems. The second issue is the issue of funding research. It is important that each and every country should take research seriously, fund research, and make sure that we include a research infrastructure, because if we have any pandemic like this one, we rely very much on research to respond. And the last part is actually the issue of medical supplies. We need to ensure that countries secure medical supplies, and they've got the capacity to produce or manufacture these medical supplies, be it PPEs or drugs or vaccines. All these are important.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Dr. Fiona Atuhebwe with the WHO Africa Region, Professor Jeffrey Mpatlele with the South African Medical Research Council, Dr. Bertha Serwa Ayi with the Kansas Health Sciences Center, and Talbert Nyenswa with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks to all of you for being with us today and sharing your valuable insights. And thanks to you, our viewers, for watching and participating with your questions and comments. Just a reminder that the conversation will continue on Facebook right after this broadcast. And one of our experts, Tolbert Yenswa, actually, will be there to answer your questions. I'm Lynn Ormoudou. Stay safe, wash your hands, and don't forget to wear your mask in public and strive to make every day a healthy day.